This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. Randy Wayne White likes offbeat adventures. He took a crash course in flying and put a Marchetti fighter through its paces with rolls and loop-de-loops and a pseudo-dogfight. He took his life in his hands diving for used golf balls in an alligator-infested pond at a posh country club. And feeling a little homesick, he hooked up with an eccentric running group in Bangkok who called themselves a drinking club with a running problem. These stories and others are collected in White's new book, The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. White lives in Florida, where he writes his very popular Doc Ford mystery novels. He had a column in Men's Health and Outside magazines. Now he writes occasional pieces for Outside. One of the stories in his new book is about White taking driving lessons at an anti-terrorism driving school in Virginia. I asked him to describe the program.
I got to this school, and it is a 7-day intensive course. It goes from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 7 days a week. Now, I suspect, like most people, I thought I was a competent driver. Marty, I'm not even close. The men... And sometimes women who went through this school are, I can't tell you what they do because they couldn't tell me. Presumably they work for the State Department in some way in the military. I know some Navy SEALs went through the school. And in the course of those 7 days, the only time I wasn't terrified was at lunch. I was a little uneasy at lunch too. But we learned how to ram cars off the road. We literally did that. Cars would pull out of the side roads and chase us, shooting guns at us, trying to run us off the road. We learned how to do boot turns, J turns. It's all in the book. It amazes me I made it through.
One of the things you said you learned was positive ocular response, driving, barricade, breaching. What were these things?
Positive ocular response is typically... obtuse government term for looking where you want to go. And that really is what it means. When you go into a slide, you know how you've been on ice, I suspect, in a car, and you start to slide and you see a tree and you go, oh my gosh, I don't want to hit the tree, I don't want to hit the tree, and you're looking at the tree. Well, guess what you're going to hit? You're going to hit the tree. So when you start to slide, you look, oh, I want to go there. I want to go where there's no tree. Go where there's no tree, and then you'll go where there's no tree. That's the whole theory.
And normally they teach what, business people, government people, how to evade if a terrorist is on their tail, that kind of thing?
They teach you how to turn an automobile into a weapon, which unfortunately too many people know how to do already. But it is, if you're under attack, turn the tables and put a little rubber on them, as they say at the school.
Well, the whole philosophy of this group was to help you be aware of terrorists that might be lurking here and there. Did you feel safer or more at risk once you graduated from the school? Did you believe now that
safer.
Terrorists were actually in hiding, waiting for you?
I felt safer because my job is to go. They essentially, editors pick out some third world hellhole, and I go there. And if I get back safely, I write about it, and that's my job. So I felt safer because I've been so many places where I've had rental cars and where there are terrorists. And I've been in terrorist attacks. And it is—I tend to joke around, but all joking aside, to be in a situation where there actually is violence, and I've been in that situation in Peru, I've been in that situation in Nicaragua and Cambodia, to be in a place where there actually is violence is a stunning, stunning experience. It's not like on weekday television where you see somebody shot and you move along your merry way and have a cappuccino. And it is, if you see real violence, you are set back for weeks.
Tell us what happened. I mean, you said Peru, Nicaragua. What happened that you were in the middle of a terrorist attack or observed one?
Peru. I was assigned to take the highest train trip in the world. The train goes from Lima, which is close to sea level, to Huancayo, which goes up over 16,000 feet. And I'm from Florida, and I live on an Indian mound. My daily elevation is about 13 feet. So I took this train, and it was supposed to be a pretty funny story because even the Indios on this train, the rapid transition from sea level to 16,000 feet, even the Indios become unwell. And... Uh, they send a woman in a white smock up and down the aisles with this bladder filled with oxygen, and she squirts this thing in your face, and it's supposed to make you feel better. Now, for me, the transition from sea level to 16,000 feet, I did not get nauseous. Maybe it's because I'm an old fishing guide. But what elevation and altitude does to me is it makes me mean, and thank goodness, because I'm normally such a sweet and gentle-hearted guy.
Makes you mean?
It made me very grumpy, very impatient. In Huancayo, when I arrived, by coincidence, this small village in the mountains was having its 416th anniversary. Music in the little village square, llamas, people playing flutes. I thought, geez, what a fun little town. And as I was standing there, this was about dusk, watching this little festival going on, two guys came up and they kind of bumped into me. And they looked at me and they spit on my boots. Now, I'm a pretty big guy, and I looked at this guy like, you couldn't possibly have meant to do that. And the guy looked at me like, yeah, we really meant to do that. And about an hour later, I was walking down a side street. It was right after sunset. And I heard two people coming up behind me. And these were two different guys because they were bigger. And they came up. I moved aside for them to pass. And I felt such an impact on my back. It drove me forward. I caught myself on a railing. And the sidewalk we were on was elevated off the street by about 2 or 3 feet. And I turned around and I hit the one guy so hard it knocked them both into the street. And they gave me the strangest look. Thinking about it now, the hair, what little hair I have, comes up in my neck. And they got up and they walked and then started to run. And I ran the other way, got back to my hotel, took off my vest. And in the back of my vest where I had my notebook, there was a rip. I took out my notebook. And there was a stab mark in it. And that's why they gave him the strange look. They couldn't figure out why I wasn't hurt.
And you had your notebook in your back, up your shirt.
Well, it gets worse. 1 hour later, and I mean, I was shaking after that. These guys just walked up and stabbed me. And 1 hour later, I heard an explosion. And the Shining Pass and Daryl Luminoso attacked the village. And that attack went on for 7 hours. Part of the hotel was blown up I was in. I saw a man shot right in our doorway. It was extraordinary.
Do you think?
And that's why in my novels, I write novels about a Florida marine biologist. Right. And some people will criticize me saying there's so little violence. And my reply is, if you've actually seen violence, you know how it affects people. And you don't use it often.
Do you think they targeted you because you were so obviously an American, or you were just...
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
1 week later in that same town, a U.S. agronomy student from Florida was traveling down the same street I was on, and they pulled him from his car, made him kneel down, they shot him in the back of his head.
Well, let me reintroduce you, and that's Randy Wayne White, our guest today on Fresh Air. He's a writer. He's got a new book. It's called The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua, and it's stories of some of his adventures around the world, some of his travel experiences, fishing as well. You're a fairly accomplished fishing guide. You did this for some time, I guess, before you turned to writing, or maybe along the same time of that. How did you get into fishing? Because one of the things that you say in writing about that is that you never intended this. You never really liked to fish.
You know, I didn't. I had a very curious life, Marty. I was a fishing guide full-time on Sanibel Island for 13 years, Sanibel Island, Florida.
That means taking people out fishing, right? I mean,
correct, yes. In a small boat. My boats ranged in size from 19 feet to 24 feet. And I was a light tackle guide. I did more than 3,000 charters.
Hmm. Were you a good guide? You say in the beginning you weren't particularly good, but did you become a good guide?
I became certainly a competent guide and held at least one world record on fly rod, specialized in saltwater fly fishing. I think certain people, men and women, have great instincts for fishing.
Yeah.
There aren't many. Many people lie about those instincts. I never had great instincts. But I certainly had a work ethic. On the days I wasn't paid to fish, I went out and fished my own.
So and you like the sea. I mean, you like the sea as well, certainly the way you write about it, that there's something very attractive about.
I like the water. I'm a waterman, and I've never felt at one with the sea. I can tell you that right now. It's frightened me. I found it haunting. I found it existential. I found it, but never warm and welcoming, I can tell you that. But I enjoyed my years as a guy to be on the water, as I was 300 days a year, to be on the water at first light, catching bait, and the qualities of wind and the odors and textures of light sticks with you.
Does fishing make you a better writer because you have to be so observant?
I think all the bills I get make me a better writer, truthfully. Unfortunately, my novels do very well, the Doc Ford books. But
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I know I enjoyed guiding. I'll tell you a quick fishing guide story. My job, as I told you, was to take people fishing. And one day down to the docks came this couple, very old, it seemed to me at that time. They were probably 55, 60, and I'm 48 now. Got in my boat, I'm taking out the small bay, and the man nudges me and said, "We don't want to fish." I said, "Well, sir, I can do that. I cannot take you fishing." He goes, "You don't understand. This is our 30th wedding anniversary. In all our lives, we've dreamed about coming to Florida and being left alone on a deserted island." Now, I know what this old goat had in mind. So I ran him up to a deserted island, beautiful coconut palms, white beach, dropped him off, came back. And he said, "Come back in 2 hours," which impressed the hell out of me, Marty. Came back 2 hours. They were standing there waiting on me in water up to the necks. And I said, "It's time to go." And the woman in this terrible falsetto wails, "We can't ever leave. The tide came in, took all our clothes away." Now, I was rigged to fish. I didn't have a boarding ladder. And by the time I got that woman in my boat, I knew her a lot better than I wanted to know her, I'll tell you that. They didn't have a stitch.
That's great. Well, I'll tell you what, I do want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest is Randy Wayne White, and he's got a new book of stories about some of his adventures traveling the world, fishing as well. It's called The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Randy Wayne White, and he has a new book of stories called The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. One of the things you say in the beginning of the book, which I found quite interesting, is the feeling that Americans have that the world hates them. Your feeling and experience as you travel the world is that the world is crazy about Americans, that we have this inferiority complex.
Well, we are a strange bunch. We denigrate, we self-denigrate and self-criticize and the ugly American. Now, I have in all my travels, I've seen a couple of ugly Americans, but not many. We are so quick to take blame. "Oh, I'm sorry, it's my fault." That's my experience. And my experience also, with the exception of Peru where I got stabbed, is that people love Americans. We're popular, they want to hang around us, they want to go do stuff with us. A quick example, I flew to Hanoi from Bangkok, jet lagged. It's a long cab ride from the airport into town, and got at my hotel probably at 2 a.m., couldn't sleep, got up, it was foggy. I decided to go for a jog. Took off jogging through the mist, through this fog, through several parks. After about an hour, I was ready to head back to the hotel. And Marty, I had this terrible realization. I didn't know what hotel I was staying at. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any identification. And I was completely lost. Now, luckily, about after 2 hours of looking for my hotel, I walked past an open bar, and there was an Australian there. And I said, "Can you help me?" I was almost in tears by this time. "Can you help me? I'm lost." "All right, mate. No worries. We can take care of that, right?" And we got these little cyclos, these pedal bicycles, and we went all over Hanoi looking for my hotel, and we would go in, and I'd go, "Am I staying here?" And by the end of that day, it seemed like I knew everybody in Hanoi, and they loved me. I was an American, and that was before it was illegal to go to Vietnam. And that was true in Vietnam. It was true in Cambodia. It's been true all through Central America, particularly in Nicaragua and Cuba. I was in Cuba 12 days, brought back 147 refugees during Mariel Harbor.
Huh.
People, in my experience,
right,
love American Americans.
And I imagine in Hanoi you were not known as the American, but that crazy American that doesn't know where he is.
Well, that one day in the hotel, some woman came in and very broken English said, "Where is Mr. America?" I was very flattered.
You wrote an article, or a series of articles, actually, for Men's Health magazine, and it was called Guys Like Us, a column in the magazine. One of the things that you wrote, and this was actually in April of this year, which I found pretty funny. Middle age is what military experts might describe as a, quote, target-rich environment. And as a self-described middle-aged man, you feel like you're a pretty big target.
Well, yeah, and I think it's that thing, middle-aged crazy, it's become trivialized. Oh, he got a wig and a sports car, he's acting like a young idiot. Marty, it is not trivial. It is, for some of us, it's debilitating. For other of us, it's deadly. And it's an important time of life. For me, it's been a wonderful time of life. But I have seen friends absolutely devastated. And that's why I wanted to write those columns for Men's Health. And I just, my attorney agent's just sending out a proposal to write a book on middle age, which I very much look forward to do. And the working title is You're Over 40, Fat Boy. And it will, for once, tell the truths of middle age that I've never read, how we really do see ourselves in terms of our relationships with women. How idiotic we are to have affairs, although almost all of us do it. It has ruined so many lives, so many families. Panic attacks. You know, we wake up at 2, 3 a.m., our hearts pounding, worried about all the people for whom we're responsible. It can be a very tough time of life. It's a funny time of life as well, but it's at any rate, it's a book I look forward to writing.
And the title, including the word fat boy, I mean, do you feel like a fat boy?
I look so darn good right now, Marty. yeah, because we kind of get fat. Your whole body changes. It's a real pisser. You know, I have back problems, and I fight it every single day. I work out twice a day, every day. I lift weights, I swim, all this stuff. Play long toss with a baseball, and the entire battle is against essentially against gravity.
Well, talking about middle age, you have a pretty funny piece that you wrote about the time you took Viagra. And again, just reading a couple things from it, I mean, the physical effects beyond the obvious ones was, you know, your cheeks were flushed and your vision was blurred and on and on and on and on. You want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, as I wrote, geez, what a dangerous drug. First it screws up your vision, then it gives you an erection. It's very, very dangerous. But the worst thing about that story was the magazine also had me try Muse, which is a more serious, it's a penile implant. It's a thing you put up. And the magazine had the Viagra tablets. They sent me three, two of which I gave to guys on my baseball team. But they said...
Did that make you very popular on your team?
It did with the wives, I'll tell you. But they said, but the Muse, if you have a doctor friend, you need to get a prescription because we don't have this stuff. And I said, well, my best friend's a cardiac surgeon. I can call him, but I don't know what's a cardiac surgeon going to be writing a script for Muse. So I called him and I said, can you get this stuff for me? He goes, well, if you want it. But now, so a week or two passes and... the magazine calls, and they said, did you get the Muse? I said, oh, yeah, my buddy, he's going to get it for me. I call my buddy. I go, did you get the Muse, this penile stuff, penile implant stuff? He goes, I didn't get it, but I called in the prescription. I said, where? And I live on an island. He said, to the island pharmacy. I went, oh, no. I go to this little tiny pharmacy on the small island where I live, and I walk in. I'm immediately sweating. And it's like a kid going in to buy condoms. And there are three women behind the counter. And one woman says to me, aren't you Randy White, the novelist? I just loved your last book, and I'm sweating. I can't stop sweating. I think I'm just going to buy a comb and some chewing gum and get out of here. And I hear this paper rattle. And she goes, oh, Mr. White, we have a prescription for you. Oh. Oh.
This is her, right?
It was absolutely humiliating. And to this, I don't know what kind of stories are circulating about me on that island, but it
Now, I have to ask you, though, but how did they convince you to try this penile implant?
Oh, well, no, it's like a little pill you stick up there. No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
No, it's,
God.
No, it's just like a little pill. And I didn't even have a partner, and it was, the whole thing was a nightmare. And of course, you can't go anywhere. You're just sticking around. Oh, it's awful.
Randy Wayne White's new book is The Sharks of Lake Nicaragua. This is Fresh Air.